This morning we're looking at the first 11 verses of John chapter 2. One of these weeks we need to have one of those, you know, those Bible drills, you know, like I'll ask everybody to grab the pew Bible in front of them and I'll read off the sermon thing and everybody... Yeah. Well, we could prove that. We could. So this is the first of the seven miracle signs that make up the first half of the book of John. And it says, on the third day, a wedding took place at Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." "Dear woman, why do you involve me?" Jesus replied. "My time has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Nearby stood six stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." So they filled them to the brim. Then he told them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet." They did so. And the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He did not realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. Then he called the bridegroom aside and said, "Everyone brings out the choice wine first, and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink. But you have saved the best till now." This, the first of his miraculous signs, Jesus performed at Cana in Galilee. He thus revealed his glory, and his disciples put their faith in him. The word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God. So, I have often thought that this is kind of a strange, I say it reverently, of course, a strange miracle. And I've often wondered, you know, why John puts it in. Obviously, Jesus did lots of miracles that aren't recorded in the Gospel of John. He did lots of miracles that aren't recorded in any Gospel, right? I believe it's at the end of the Gospel of John where they says, if we were to write down everything he did, you know, this we wouldn't have enough paper and ink for it. So John is kind of consciously selected. He's pulled out specific miracles to make specific points, and he's passed over a lot of other ones. And that's always, with this particular one, been very strange to me, because if you look at it, you know, if we can say it and understand what we're saying, it's kind of trivial. You know, you look at most of the miracles, and you have somebody, you know, who's been suffering all their life. You know, somebody who's a social outcast for leprosy and in great pain. People who've been blind from birth. People who've been bent over for 12 years. People who have... been close to 40 years laying beside the pool of Bethesda waiting for healing. You know, you have people in dire, dire, dire straits, and Jesus comes along, and they are rescued. Their lives are changed. You know, they're dramatic, real help in real need. And, you know, if you read the commentaries, they'll kind of say that, you know, this is a bigger deal than it looks like. You know, this young couple, if they were to run out of wine in the middle of their ceremony, this would be an embarrassment that they would never live down for the rest of their lives. This would haunt them. You know, this is actually a big deal. But it's still, in comparison with the other things that goes on, again, reverently, it seems like a trivial miracle. You know, even if there were these cultural elements that we don't have a sense of, I don't picture the bridegroom here coming to Jesus and falling on his knees, clasping Jesus' feet and saying, "Oh Lord, have mercy! Save me from this cultural embarrassment!" You know, it seems somewhat strange, especially because you look at the other miracles, even the later miracles where there's not somebody like being rescued from a lifelong illness or something, then after the miracle, because there are other ones that are, you know, what I would reverently say trivial, the feeding of the 5,000, right? Tremendous miracle, amazing that he could do it, but people went away having had a meal. right? But then Jesus used it to teach, to make these points. The miracle was an illustration of the things that he went on to teach. And we don't even have any teaching here. Jesus doesn't go on to explain what this is all symbolic of. And we don't even know who's aware of what he did. We know that the stewards and his disciples, but the end point of it, he says that his disciples believed in him. You know, there was no even, half the people there probably didn't even know what happened. And so with those kind of thoughts of, you know, why is John recorded this? And then John's final statement about it is he says, thus he revealed his glory. You know, which for me has always kind of heightened the difficulty of this miracle. It comes across, again, somewhat kind of unimportant. And then John says about it, and this was a revelation of the glory of God. And so I've always kind of struggled and thought, well, in what way is God's glory being revealed here? And, you know, if I can, in modern times, you know, the sense of it is almost kind of like the glory of Jesus is that, you know, he's the guy who sprung for the last keg when they ran out. You know, I mean, again, reverently, very reverently. But there's that kind of sense of what's going on here that John goes so far as to say, and thus he revealed his glory. And, you know, to have those kind of questions, that's not the pious thing to do. The pious thing to do is just to make, oh, yes, oh, that's amazing, that's glorious, and not let yourself question, well, why does John do this? This doesn't seem glorious to me. You know, I have a real high idea of the glory of God. If Andy was going to do this, yeah, this would be glorious for Andy. But, you know, when God just provides the wine for a wedding, you know, that's to me, that falls short of the glory of God. And it's okay to ask those questions, because by asking those questions, then you get to the point where God can answer them. If you don't allow yourself to struggle and say, well, Lord, this doesn't seem worthy of you. This doesn't seem as... There's something I'm missing, is what we come around to. And when we recognize that maybe there's something we're missing, then the Lord can show it to us. This week, as I was looking at this, the other miracles that were coming to mind, and I think primarily because I've always thought that they're kind of trivial as well, are three miracles that Elisha did in 2 Kings. In 2 Kings 2, Elisha comes to a town, and the people of the town complain that it's a great place. Look at this view that we have. We love it here, but the water's bad. And because the water was bad, no crops would grow, and people were ill all the time. And so Elisha poured some salt into the spring of water, and the water was cleansed. And the water then was good, clean water. And then two chapters later, in 2 Kings 4, there's an incident where Elisha comes to a group of prophets. Prophets weren't always the guys like Elisha and Elijah who were just off by themselves doing things. There were these colonies of more or less professional prophets, and their kids would become prophets after them. So he comes to one of these colonies of about 100 guys, and there's famine in the land. So they manage to put together some porridge, and one of the guys collects some wild gourds and cuts them up into the porridge, and they turn out to be poisonous. And when they start to eat, somebody cries out, "Elisha! There's death in the pot." Anyone remember that line? I love that line. "There's death in the pot." Yes. That's one you can use sometime. Kind of keep it in your back pocket. You never know when a phrase like that comes in handy. So Elisha dumps a cup of flour into the porridge, and it's cleansed. He says, "Now you can eat it," and everybody eats it. And then the last one is Elisha multiplied bread, very similarly to the way that Jesus did in the Gospels. A man comes with some loaves of bread for the prophets, and he says, "How can I set these before 100 men?" And Elisha said, "Oh, just pass it out. It won't run out." And it doesn't run out. He multiplies the bread. And I was looking at those, again, because it, you know, somewhat mundane things being dealt with. And then it occurred to me that there's a real major difference. Those things that Elisha did, he cleansed something, right? You know, like the water or the porridge. He fixed something that was wrong. Or with the bread, he multiplied something that was already there, right? But then with Jesus, with the water turning into wine, he fundamentally changes one thing into another. He doesn't take something that's already there and cleanse it. or purify it, or add something to it, or take something away from it. He changes it. Transformation. People use the word transformation nowadays all over the place. And it drives me crazy because most of them aren't talking about something that's transformation, right? When your kid grows up, it might look like a transformation. It's not a transformation, right? It's like an acorn growing into an oak tree. That's not a transformation. Everything that the tree is there in the acorn. It's just growth. It's a progression. It's a normal development. Transformation is when one thing turns into something that it is not. Right? Like the alchemists who were after the secret somehow to turn lead into gold. And we laugh at that and we say, no, they're fundamentally different things at the atomic level. Not even the molecular level, which you could then break down and put back together again differently. But at the atomic level, they're fundamentally different things. They're basic elements and they are separate. And you will never turn lead into gold. Right? But that's exactly what Jesus does. He takes water and he changes it into wine. He doesn't just cleanse the water. It's not like if you have water and you take out the bad stuff, then you end up with wine. He changes one thing into something else, and the two are different things. It's an act of creation, right? And that's one of the themes that John plays up. He's constantly presenting Jesus as equal with God the Father. Everything God the Father does, Jesus does. So it's an act of creation. But particularly this idea of turning one thing into something else that's fundamentally different. Changing the essential core nature of something. That's Jesus' glory. That's the revelation of glory. That's why John here says, thus his glory was revealed. His glory is revealed that he is able, has the power and the authority to turn something into something else entirely, which it was not. When the acorn grows into the oak tree, it always was an oak tree. Everything in the oak tree, it was all there in the acorn. When the water turns into wine, or when Jesus lays his hand on a human heart, it becomes something that was never there to begin with. When I came to the Lord, I know I kind of talk about this a lot, but it's kind of an important event in my life. When I was growing up, I was not really aware of any particular needs. Everything that came along, I could deal with, kind of never had any significant problems. And then the Lord graciously, in his mercy, brought about real problems, right? Things that I could no longer deal with. And my conversion really had nothing to do with sin. My conversion had to do with there are these needs out there, there are problems, and there are pressures that I can't deal with, that are beyond my ability. Now, for me, that was a really genuine conversion because I had never even thought that there might be something that I couldn't deal with. You know, I was the master of my own fate, the captain of my ship, you know, all that kind of proud stuff. And for me, that was a real major humbling experience to realize that I was not in control of my life, that there were things out there that I would not be able to deal with, and to cry out and ask for help. But the basic thing that needed to happen is I needed Jesus to fix that stuff out there, which he did. And in that, I was really genuinely converted and born again because I saw that Jesus is Lord, that he's real, and he's in my life changing things. But then, as I started reading the Bible and I began to have a better, clearer idea of who Jesus is, of what he wants to do in a human life, of what he wants a human life to look like, then I became more aware of my needs, right? And the first thing is I began to notice that there were things that ought to be in my life that weren't. And so begin the prayers of, Lord, help me to be nice. You know, help me to notice other people. Lord, please give me more patience. Lord, give me more love. Give me that attitude that you had, right? And begin these prayers of asking the Lord to add something to who I am. And at the same time, as you're reading the Bible and as you're growing in the Lord, you begin to really understand sins. You begin to see that this thing that you do, it's not okay. And so you ask for forgiveness, right? That's another element of what the Lord does, and it's an important one. And I, too, began to understand that I was at fault. I began to have real feelings of guilt for the first time in my life. And I began to sincerely ask for forgiveness. And also, then as you ask for forgiveness once, and then the next day you do the same thing again, and a week later you're doing the same thing again, you begin to cry out, to ask the Lord to take these things away from you. right? You begin to realize that there are not only lacks that you need the Lord to fill up, but there are things in us that we need him to get rid of. And Lord, get rid of my anger. Lord, help me deal with this sin. Help me deal with these bad habits. Help me to change this part about my life. But you know what? All of these different, and that's all growth. That was all an increasing understanding of what the Lord could do and wanted to do in my life. But all of these things were still not changing who I am. Do you know what I mean? This is all still at the level of either external things or add something to me, take something away from me. But it doesn't address just the fundamental question of who am I? What am I? It's not me being changed, it's adding something or taking away something, multiplying something, like the bread, you know, taking my good characters and characteristics and stretching them all out and taking my faults and kind of shrinking them down. Growth, development, acorn turning into oak tree type of Christian growth. For me, the turning point was about 4 years after I had been born again. It was an evening. I was in our third floor apartment in Gorham. Esme had gone out to a prayer meeting. Aaron was asleep. He was a baby at the time. And I sincerely wish that I could remember the specific circumstances. But I was at one of the lowest points of my life. I don't remember what specifically was going on, but I know that I was seeing more clearly than ever, and probably for the first time clearly, that the problem is not the sins that I do. The problem is that I am a sinner. Of course, I had heard that, and I knew that, and I said it, and I probably knew the phrase that you're not a sinner because you sin because you're a sinner, right? But then I finally really saw it and understood it. That the problem is not the things that I do. The problem is that I, essentially, basically, who I am, is a sinner. And that everything I do is going to be touched with that sin, the way that everything comes from an apple tree is touched with appleness. Everything about an apple tree is apple. Because apple is the core of what the tree is. Right? And it can't bring forth anything other than apples. That in the same way, I was a sinner, and everything that I did would be touched with that sin. My best intentions, my best ideas to help someone, all my efforts would not work the way I wanted them to work. And the worst part of it was, I would want to help, and people would be hurt. I would want to bring in a good idea, and people would end up worse off. And the closer somebody was to me, the worse they suffered. And that's why I wish I could remember more of the specifics, because I know that a lot of it had to do with my relationship with Esme. A lot of it had to do with just the reality of marriage and wanting things to be better and working hard for things to be better, and yet everything that comes out of everything I try to do, seeing it stained with sin. And recognizing for the first time thoroughly, clearly, that this is who I am. And this will never be any different as long as who I am. And I remember struggling with that thought and literally, 100% honestly, from the depths of my soul, crying out to the Lord, Lord, if this is all I can expect, if this can't change, if this is what life is going to be like, if I am always going to be this detrimental to everyone around me, and if everyone I come in touch with is only going to be touched and affected by me, and if it's only my life, which I know hurts, then Lord, kill me. It was an earnest, honest prayer. Lord, if this life, if this is what I'm living right now, if this is all the Christian life can be, kill me. Because people are hurting because of me. And he did kill me. Just not the way that I thought. Right? He killed me spiritually. He brought me to the cross and put me to death. Which is exactly the change that needs to happen. He can change us. This is what Jesus does. That night, I finally saw the real need of the human heart. The real need is for the sinner to be turned into the life of Christ. For the life of Adam to be turned into the life of Christ. The life of Adam can't know anything other than sin and death, because that's who he is. He's a sinner. And sometimes we'll think, well, it doesn't seem that bad. But that's because we don't have a sense of it. Ask the fish what it's like to live in water, right? Everybody knows that that's a classic example. The fish says, "What water?" The fish has never known anything but water. The fish has never noticed the water. In the same way, we live in this nature of sin and death, and we don't even recognize it because we've never known anything else. The thorn bush brings forth thorns. That night I saw, I am a thorn. And you can take that thorn bush and you can plant it in a vineyard and you can treat it like a grapevine and you can do all the grapevine stuff to it and you can water it and you can fertilize it and you can prune it and you can do everything and it will only bring out bigger and bigger thorns. The only thing that can be done with a thorn bush is to rip it out and plant a grapevine in its place. And that's exactly what Jesus does. That's what this miracle is about, that Jesus can change the essential nature of something. As long as your prayer, your desire, your view of what the Lord Jesus can do for you is, Lord, give me more patience. As long as it's, Lord, fix these problems. Lord, help me get along with my coworker. Lord, stretch out my good stuff. You know me when I'm at my best. Help me be that way all the time. Lord, just shrink down my Irish temper. Lord, just shrink down my tendency to be defensive. As long as that's what we're asking for, the Lord will do it. He really will, because he's eager to be involved and to help us. But we fall far, far short of what it is that he really wants to do. We fall short of what it is his glory to do, which is to transform, not the way we use it nowadays, but the real way. To turn something into something that is fundamentally different. A.B. Simpson was the founder of the Christian Missionary Alliance. He was the premier preacher of his day at the end of the 20th century. And he would tell a story of a man selling a kind of a small cottage, maybe even a hovel, this kind of small little rundown house. And interestingly enough, a very, very wealthy kind of millionaire tycoon type is interested in it, maybe because of the location or something. And so showing him the house, the seller is very eager to make the sale and is kind of pointing out that, you know, with just some, I know it doesn't look like much, but with some new cabinets here and, you know, this kitchen would be really first rate. You know, if you take out this wall over here, you can have a great view from the kitchen. Oh, and the upstairs, yeah, there's no bathroom upstairs, but there's a closet over there that could make a really good half bath. You know, he understands the place doesn't look so nice. He's trying to give the wealthy guy a vision. Finally, the millionaire just cuts him off and says, "My dear man," or maybe, "My dear mom," whatever, "and I have no use for your hovel. Before the ink is dry on the sail, the bulldozers will have taken it away. But in its place, I am going to build such a palace that you can't even imagine." Right? That's what Jesus wants to do in our lives. That's the extent of the change. He's not going to just take our house and clean it up a little bit. Right? When Jesus comes into your life, he's not interested in just putting up fresh wallpaper and putting up modern light fixtures. But you know what? One of our problems is that's exactly what we want him to do. Because essentially, we like ourselves. That's part of the whole sin nature that's in there. Essentially, we think we're really pretty good. The only problem is this temper. The only problem is this defensiveness. The only problem is that I'm too stressed out. The only problem is this or that or third. You have your own thing that you point your finger at. We all think that the problem is just this little thing that just has to be dealt with. And then, Lord, you know what's in my heart. You know my intentions. You know my desires. You know. But it's hogwash. And until we really get to that point, we're not ready to see what the Lord really wants to do. We're asking him for a little bit. We read through the gifts of the Spirit or the fruit of the Spirit, and we ask him for a little bit more of all of those, like fresh light fixtures and new wallpaper, a little bit of paint on the outside, and maybe some new shutters. Those are getting pretty worn out. But we think that the basic nature, the core, who we are, we think it's okay. And the thing is that it's not. There is no life that's okay other than the life of Jesus Christ. Every one of us will be quick to point out that he is the only life that has ever been lived on earth acceptable to God. But do we understand the implications of that? His is the only life that's acceptable to God. His is the life, his is the only life that's pleasing to God. No matter how much God helps you to clean your act up, it will never be what it is supposed to be, because you're Adam. And Christ is pleasing to God. And that's what Jesus can do. He can turn Adam into Christ. He takes that life at the core of who you are, and he sends it to the cross. And it's a painful experience. It hurts, and everything in us wants to avoid it. And everything in us runs and looks for any possible way out. And the Lord shuts door after door after door so that we are brought smack up to the cross at the foot of it, where we see that there's no alternative left but to open your arms and die. But when we do that, the hovel is cleared away and the Lord builds that palace that is his very own life. And we, like Paul, get up and say, "Oh my golly!" Right? And we cry out like he does in Galatians 2:20, "This isn't me! This is not my life. I lived with me for 20 years. I know who I am like. This is not me. This is Jesus Christ living in me." That's the glory. That's the glory that John is talking about. When he changed the water into wine, he was demonstrating that he has the power to change one thing into something that is fundamentally something else. That's what he wants to do with us. The question is, do we let him do it? And the first thing to letting him do it is just having your eyes open to the need of it. Have you really seen what sin actually is in your heart? Do you know what it is to be a sinner? I think that we have a conservative kind of church here. I think everybody would say, "Yeah, I'm a sinner." I don't think anybody would raise a hand and say, "No, that's not me." Right? There are people out there. You guys know them, right? But do you know what that means? Do you agree with the fact that you are a sinner because you know that, "Yeah, well, you know, about once a month I really lose it with the kids." Right? Or do you understand that all the rest of the time you're just kind of making it look okay? Right? Do we really understand what the depth of our need is? And then, are we willing to let Jesus do what he wants with us? And of course, all of this is presupposing that somebody has really been born again. Right? Will we really let him do what he wants with us? When the bulldozers show up, when the gardener shows up with the spade to dig out the thorn bush, will we let him do it? Because you know what? He doesn't force it. He doesn't force it. He'll put you in that tight, tight spot. But if you really want to, there'll be a way out. And you can avoid it. You can get away from the work of God in your own heart. And that's terrifying. And I've shared with you before some of the people who I've known who, they're still young, so I trust the Lord to get his work done. But people who thus far have done a fantastic job of avoiding the work of the Lord. And it's ugly. I don't envy it. It terrifies me. The thing that I find more terrifying than anything else is that I would ever step back and not allow the Lord to do what he wants in my heart. Because then what do you have? You have yourself. I had myself. I don't want myself. The glory that's revealed in this first sign is that Jesus can turn something into something else that's fundamentally different. In the place of water, there's wine. In the place of a hovel, there's a palace. In place of a thorn bush, it's grapevine. In the place of Adam, Jesus. In the place of darkness, light. In the place of death, life. And that is the change that Jesus can and wants to do. The beginning of the gospel, it said, "Yet to all who received him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God, children born not of natural descent, nor of human decision or a husband's will, but born of God." Amen.